Well, the subject I have today is sort of a follow-up on a message that I gave a year ago. Turns out it was July 15th of last year when I did a message on deacons indeed. Today I want to cover a related subject, and I think it's a logical outgrowth of the other. And today it's going to be on elders indeed. Most of us have a picture in our mind of what an elder is. We regard elder as a term referring to the ordained ministry. The thing is, the New Testament refers to that term in a much broader sense, and it's that broader sense that I want to bring out today. Who are elders in the church? I just completed, in fact, it was only yesterday that I picked up the printed copies of these, and there's in the top pocket over there, there's several of them if you want to have a copy of this booklet. Title is Apostles, Prophets, and Evangelists. And it's sort of built on that seminar I did back at the Feast in 2012, where we defined those terms, because they're not entirely what we perceive them to be. But that's a little broader subject than I want to cover today. I want to talk about elders. Who are elders? How do you become one? And what do they do in the church? It's interesting that when we look through the entirety of the Bible, we see elders mentioned in a lot of different situations. For example, Israel in the wilderness had elders, and they're referred to as elders of the people. These weren't necessarily the priests. Now, it might have included the priests in many cases, but when we see how many there were, we have to know they weren't all priests. These elders were something more than that. Keep in mind, there were 12 tribes. The Levites were only one tribe, and it was the smallest of the tribes, numerically. Also, the Old Testament priesthood had elders. There's a pattern there. The first century Jewish religion had elders, also called the elders of the people, and these weren't necessarily Levite priests. Keep in mind that much of the Judaic nation was the tribes of Judah and Benjamin with only a sprinkling of Levi. The New Testament church had elders. And we will read that there were several ordained in each congregation. When that's talking about elders being ordained, does that mean that they're ministers? Well, we're going to see the way the term is used, that it's not necessarily referring to the formal or the official ministry. Something to keep in mind. But even more interesting is the fact that God's throne in heaven has 24 elders, and they're mentioned numerous times. Now, by reflection, we must realize that these elders in heaven predate the creation of man. They predate the establishment of the nation of Israel. They predate any of these other physical elders that we read of. So what exists in God's throne is replicated on his nations on earth. In Exodus 3:16 and 4:29, let's go to Exodus 3:16. We read where Moses says, And God said, moreover, unto Moses, this is verse 15, so this is God speaking, In verse 16, "Go and gather the elders of Israel together and say unto them, The Lord God of your fathers, the God of Abraham and Isaac and of Jacob, appeared unto me, saying, I have surely visited you and seen that which is done to you in Egypt." So even before the nation escaped bondage in Egypt, there were elders of the people, even in the enslaved conditions. These were not necessarily appointed by any Levitical priesthood because there wasn't one yet. That was basically established later, a year into the Exodus. Who were these elders of the people? And keep in mind, around the time of the Exodus and all pretty much all the way through the 40 years, the population of Israel was from 2 to 3 millions. 600,000 men of the age of war. Now Moses was directed to appoint leadership in the nation. And if we're going to base it on 600,000 military capable men, and this is in Numbers 146, we find that there is some 603,000 military capable men. And he was to appoint rulers of thousands, rulers of hundreds, and rulers of 50. So if we base it just on the 600,000, that means there were 6,000 rulers of hundreds and 12,000 rulers of 50s and 60,000 rulers of 10s, making a total of at least 78,600 who were appointed to this task. How did Moses and Aaron know that many people? How did they know who to appoint as representatives? Well, the point is, they didn't. It would be an unusual person who could know and name 1,000 people in their acquaintances. So obviously, someone helped with the choosing. That's the point I want to bring out here. We know they weren't Levites. So we know they weren't made elders of the people on the basis of their being Levites, because there was only 22,000 Levites. You should read that in Numbers 3:39. That's only about 28% of what you would need. So obviously, these elders were a broader spectrum of people. And that was the pattern that was used in the development of the physical nation and later the spiritual nation throughout the rest of time. Will there be elders in the millennial kingdom? Why would there not be? But the basic point is, who are these elders and what do they do? And what are they authorized to do? What we need to consider here, that elder in this application doesn't necessarily mean priest or minister. It does not necessarily mean someone who is ordained. Now, ordained in itself is an interesting word because we tend to think of it as a formal ordination ceremony where people are given a position who are authorized to be ministry to serve the people. That is the modern day picture. But even the word ordained has a broader meaning. For example, the sun is ordained to rise every morning, ordained by God. The moon is ordained to go through its cycle every lunar month. Has nothing whatever to do with ordination as we would think of it. In Acts 13:48, there's an interesting verse. Acts 13:48. And when the Gentiles heard this, they were glad and glorified the word of the Lord, and as many as were ordained to eternal life believed. That tells us that the term ordain has a little broader meaning than we might otherwise think. And that word for ordain there is Strong's number 5021. Now, regarding the early Jewish religion, there's a number of places that elders are referred to. There are elders in the Jewish religion. Who were they? Were they the priests? Were they the scribes? Were they the Pharisees? Were they the Sanhedrin? Who were these elders? Well, I'm going to go through this kind of quickly. You don't need to look all these references up. But in interest of time, I'm going to read off my cheat sheet. But let's look at a few. Matthew 16:21. From that time forth, Jesus began to show unto his disciples how that he must go unto Jerusalem and suffer many things of the elders and the chief priests and the scribes and be killed and raised again the third day. Elders are mentioned separately of the chief priests and scribes. In Matthew 21:23. And when he was come into the temple, the chief priests and the elders of the people, there's that same term that was used back in the time of the Exodus, the elders of the people came unto him as he was teaching and said, by what authority do you do these things? And who gave you this authority? These elders were interested in the subject of authority. That was their area of concern, it seems. He wasn't a priest, so that question was answered. The priests wouldn't have asked the question because they knew he wasn't a priest. The elders of the people were wondering what gave him the authority. In verse 47 of Matthew 26, and while he yet spoke, lo, Judas, one of the 12, came with him, a great multitude with swords and staves, from the chief priests and the elders of the people. Here again, the elders are mentioned distinctly, separately, of the priesthood. Verse 57 of the same chapter. And they that laid hold on Jesus led him away to Caiaphas the high priest, where the scribes and the elders were assembled. So the elders were distinct and separate of the scribes as well. Verse 59 of the same chapter. Now the chief priests and elders and all the council sought false witness against Jesus to put him to death. Now here again, we have a distinction. The priests, the elders, and all the council. The council was the Sanhedrin. So these elders weren't the Sanhedrin either. Matthew 27, verse 1. When morning was come, all the chief priests and elders of the people took counsel against Jesus to put him to death. There's numerous places I could read more, but I'll let that suffice. But we have elders of the people functioning in the old Jewish religion who are not priests necessarily. It might have included some, we don't know. But they're looked at as a distinct and separate entity. Now, it's also interesting, the high priests went into Pilate to get the tomb sealed and to set a watch while Christ was in the tomb. And that verse, you'll notice, the elders are left out. It was the priesthood who did that. That kind of gives us a clue also as to what regard the elders had. They weren't participants in the sealing of the tomb or setting the watch. So there was Old Testament elders, and there was New Testament church elders. We might take a moment to back up, because the question of ordination is obviously heavy in this picture. And I maybe should preface this by saying, I've written a lot of things regarding the subject of church government. Of course, it was a major topic amongst ourselves in the last 20 or 30 years. In fact, I've written a number of booklets on the subject, but I never took this subject into regard until recently. I've written books on church government. There's some one over there, The Bride's Oversight, and the big one, The End Time Church, Ready Through Adversity. There's over 220 pages altogether in these three booklets that address this subject of how God's church ought to be governed. In fact, this booklet covers the examining the biblical model of church government. It has a chapter on deacons indeed, which kind of covers that subject that I presented a year ago. It has a chapter on elders indeed, which covers today's message. Chapter 4, appreciating the worldwide experience. There's certain things we should have gained from that experience. And then chapter 5 is very interesting because it is titled Nicolaitanism. And it's a four-page article that appeared in 1992 in the American Christian magazine. It's written from a Protestant perspective, but it is amazing how they hit every one of these points of the two-tier hierarchical system of government that affects so many denominations, including towards the end of our own. But they had no knowledge of us, and they weren't writing this article with us in mind. This was regarding themselves. But they provide such an interesting definition of what Nicolaitanism is, which Christ says in Revelation 2, he hates. What is Nicolaitanism? Something we should know. There are chapters that cover that. I won't take the time. But it has to do with this thing of ordination. We have a picture of what ordination means. We have a picture in our minds of how an ordination is done and what it represents. The word ordained in the New Testament is translated from many, many different words. I think there's as many as 13 of them. And there's about three or four that are common. But the one that is most closely associated with the operation that we would call ordination is Strong's Greek number 5500. And it's comparative of 5495. It's the word tieno, which means to stretch. It indicates someone who is a hand reacher or voter. It indicates that someone expresses their view by a raising of the hands, generally to select or appoint, to choose or to ordain. Did you ever hear that definition given? It's been written for hundreds of years. Ordain involves the raising of hands. And that reflects back to the situation in the Exodus generation. How did they know who was an elder? Who did the choosing of who would be an elder and who wouldn't? Obviously, it was the people. The people knew their fellow brethren who were around and who had exhibited the qualities of character and talents and knowledge and wisdom and tact that the leadership would not have known simply by the fact that the group was so huge. Now, when we come to Acts 15, where we have a similar situation where the apostles were overtaxed in duties, they needed help. They needed assistance. So what did they do? They went out and picked seven people. No, they didn't. They charged the congregation there, the recipients of their service, they charged them to go and select seven men among you. The apostles themselves, even though they were there, even though a number of them were there, they didn't pick who was to be these seven. Why was that? Because the people, by experience, would have seen the conduct of those among them and would have known their qualities better than the leadership would have known. It was the church, it was the membership who selected who these seven would be. Now there's a benefit of that, because when something like that is done, the people would be more content with the choices. Think about it. Think about your past history in the church. I can recall our situation back east, where there was a time when the church congregation was growing to the point where they needed more deacons. So the minister chose three deacons. And after years of experience with these people, it was so obvious to me. He picked the three men out of the congregation who had the least tact of anybody among us. They're all gone now. They went haywire when things happened. And many of us, others, are still with it, still strong. But when, if the congregation had chosen those three deacons, we would have had a different bunch of people. So there's a benefit to a congregation who has experience with various individuals at least nominating who should be considered for service, who should be considered for a position of authority, whether minor or major. There is a benefit to the congregation functioning in this way. Now, these elders that we read of in the New Testament, they're always mentioned in a plurality. It's not an elder or a single elder. Where the church is singular, when they're mentioned together, when the church is mentioned, it's singular. But when elders are mentioned, it's plural. So the elders in the church were a number of people. Why is that? Well, there's that thing of the benefit of the multitude of counsel. There is a benefit of varying opinions being weighed and brought into the picture. You get better answers among a consensus than you do just any single person in authority. And that's important. And that's what God wants in His church, for the elders of the congregation, however they're determined, the elders should weigh in on important matters. There should be a consensus. That creates a stronger dynamic in the church, as opposed to a single person in authority. Now, there should be a single person in authority, or at least a few, simply because it's necessary for a determined operation of a congregation. But those who make the decisions should take into account the experience and the wisdom of those who have been in the faith for so many years. The elder Timothy, I don't want to know if I want to call him that. Timothy was a minister. We read of his quote-unquote ordination in 1 Timothy 4:14. 1 Timothy 4:14. Neglect not the gift that is in you, which was given you by prophecy, with the laying on of the hands of the presbytery. Now there the original Greek word for elder is preserved, untranslated. It's basically transliterated. But the presbytery there were the elders. Timothy was, quote-unquote, ordained by the laying on of the hands of the elders. There weren't a lot of apostles, there weren't a lot of prophets or evangelists present when this happened. It was the elder people in the congregation who laid hands upon him. Now go up a few verses. In verse 12, Paul says to Timothy, "Let no man despise your youth, but be you an example of the believers in word, in conversation, in charity, in spirit, in faith, in purity." Why would anyone despise his youth? They're about to ordain this fellow. On the basis of what would they despise his youth? Well, obviously they're older. So these older presbyters, the elders, literal elders in this case, were the ones that laid hands upon Timothy. Now he was yet, admittedly, inexperienced at that point in time. Paul instructs him in verse 12 how to conduct himself. But there's another interesting passage relative to this, where he refers to these people as the pillars and grounds of the truth. I think it's 1 Timothy 3:15, if I'm right. Yes, there it is, across the page. "But if I tarry long, that thou mayest know how you ought to behave yourself in the house of God, which is the church of the living God, the pillar and ground of the truth." Who is Paul referring to? How is he to conduct himself in the congregation where he was serving? Paul refers to the people there. This is not a gathering of ministers. This is referring to the people. This is referring to the church itself, the congregation. He refers to them as the pillar and ground of the truth. These were the people who gave stability to the belief system. These were the people who, in a few verses later, laid hands upon Timothy to ordain him. Can a lower functionary, can a lower office ordain a higher office? That's what we see here, apparently. Timothy was not ordained by anyone above himself. Paul wasn't even there himself. He's writing this letter to him. Do you see the picture? These who were the pillars and grounds of the truth understood, and they preserved the faith as it was delivered. These were people who were experienced, who had wisdom, and who were strong in the faith. That's who laid hands on Timothy. And verse 14 refers to them as the presbytery. This was not a gathering of ministers. These presbyters were, if we could translate the word in that place as it was in any other place, elders. These were the elders. But we still haven't answered the question fully. Who are these elders? Let's look at some examples. Let's briefly go to Acts 15:2. Acts 15. Verse 2. When therefore Paul and Barnabas had no small dissension and disputation with them, there is some matter of disagreement that came to the surface. They determined that Paul and Barnabas and certain other of them should go up to Jerusalem unto the apostles and elders about this question. It distinguishes elders from apostles. And at that point in time, apostles were basically the major office in the church. Other offices were named later. But right here, we've got elders and we've got apostles. The point is that the elders weighed in on these matters, whoever they were. In Acts 15:22, regarding the developments here, they wrote letters by them after this manner. The apostles and elders and brethren send greeting unto you, unto the brethren which are of the Gentiles in Antioch and Syria and Cilicia. Here again, the elders are mentioned distinctly and separately of the apostles, and they're mentioned separately of the brethren. There are three categories of people named in this letter: apostles, elders, and brethren. Now, why was it important when they sent this letter to have that much of a consensus on the particular matter that they were weighing in on? It was important to the recipients to know that there was such solid support for the decision that had been made. And who made the decision? Basically, the whole church. Who else would there have been besides the apostles and elders and brethren? This decision involved the whole church. We see the apostles and elders mentioned in Acts 15, verse 2, verse 4, verse 6, verse 22, and verse 23. The church elders were a body whose opinions mattered. That's the thing we need to understand. It is not naming them as an authoritarian rank necessarily. It could have involved the servants, the deacons, the local elders, certainly. But it is a larger contingent of people than just the formal ministry. In Acts 14:23, we read, "And when they had ordained them elders in every church," there again the elders is plural, the church is singular. This is not one elder in each congregation. This is a plurality of elders in every church. And the word for ordained there is that Strong's 5500, which pictures hand raising. Well, who would raise their hands? Would the ministry need to raise their hands? There's only one or two or three at the most, probably. No, it's the congregation. They took a poll among the congregation. That's how they identified elders in every church. Titus 1:5 reads this way: "For this cause left I in Crete, that you should set in order the things that are wanting." Something wasn't fully being addressed here. And he tells them to ordain elders in every church as I had appointed you. There again, ordain is 5,500. The pattern was, the approach was, every time there was a congregation of any consequence, they would nominate and they would appoint a number of elders in every church. What for? What would they do? Obviously, they would have some input into what's going on. Obviously, they would have some oversight. Obviously, they would have some say in how things were done. There are verses, I won't take the time to go there, but to show that the members chose who would go with the Apostle Paul on some of his missionary journeys. Paul didn't choose the person himself. The congregation chose. There's a passage that talks about what to do when there is an offense between one member and another in the church. It's in Matthew 18. We basically know the story. We won't take the time. But if someone offends you, you go and talk to the person one-on-one. And if you don't get anywhere there, you take a witness with you for a second approach. And if the guy is still a clunkhead and won't give in or admit to anything, you take it to the church. Who is the church? In the past, we would take the approach that the church was the leader of the church, therefore you could tattle to the minister on the person. No. It wasn't the minister you take it to. What if the minister was the offender? I can give you one of those examples. Don't laugh. Then you know it worked. If you're going to do it right, you take it to the church, which is basically referring to the broader congregation. And particularly, you would want the elders. Not necessarily the formal ministry. It might involve them in some cases, but it's the congregation. In 1 Corinthians 14:29, it talks about let the prophets, and that's the inspired speakers, speak two or three, and let the others judge. Who were these judges? Was it the other prophets, or was it those who were hearing him? Those who were doing the hearing, whoever they were, should evaluate. In 1 Peter 5, he says, who myself am an elder? Was Peter demoting himself? No. Peter was referring to his age in this case. There are elders who are elders by nature of their age, not necessarily being ordained to anything. In 1 Peter 5, 1 and 2, Peter draws three basic elements together in one verse. And I think we should look at that. 1 Peter 5. He says this, the elders which are among you, I exhort. Why would Paul be exhorting the ministry? Wouldn't he do that privately? No, he's talking to the congregation which has elders within it. The elders which are among you, I exhort, who am also an elder. Here he's referring to his age, not his office necessarily. And a witness of the sufferings of Christ and also a partaker of the glory that shall be revealed. To the elders, he says, feed the flock of God, which is among you, taking the oversight thereof, not by constraint, but willingly, not for filthy lucre, but of a ready mind, neither as being lords over God's heritage, but being examples to the flocks. In these verses, we have a very clear picture of who and what elders are and what they do. They are teachers. They lead and guide the congregation. Not necessarily in a formal manner, and certainly not taking advantage of any position to lord it over the people, as we read in verse 3. But he mentions three different aspects here. The elders are shepherds, and their overseers. Shepherds were the deacons. Overseers were, is translated in some places, as bishops. But he ties all three together in one verse. In 1 Timothy 5, 1 and 2, 1 Timothy 5, 1 and 2, it says, "Rebuke not an elder, but entreat him as a father." And this gives us a picture of who these elders are in the congregation. If this were talking about the formal ministry, this would be obvious. But it's talking about the elders who are truly elders. Elders in the faith, at least. Whether they're elders in age is another question. But certainly, elders in experience, in the truth. "Rebuke not an elder, but entreat him as a father, and the younger men as brethren." So we have a contrast between the older and the younger. "The elder women," elder women, "as mothers, the younger as sisters, with all purity. Honor widows that are widows indeed." But here it's talking about elders in the sense more of their age than their position. That's something we need to take into account. The practice of ordination creates its own situation, and we, I'm sure from experience, would realize this. Ordination, as we conceive of it, and as the church has practiced it, has always created a schism in the church. It divides the clergy from the laity. That's the term that we see so often in the Nicolaitan concept. Jesus Christ expected all of those that he has called to be brethren. And they certainly are. The elders are among the, or the ministers are among the brethren, certainly. But the way it's practiced in this world, there is a divide. And that divide causes its own problems. It sets the ministry, it sets the ordained ministry, I'll use the modern term, above the people. And that causes a number of things. Number one, the people are reluctant to offer their oversight. They're reluctant to give their opinions because they don't know who's going to tattle on them and take the word up to the ministry and create a problem. It puts a damper on the function of the elders in the church that should be there. No minister should be above scrutiny. That's one of the things that's given to the people, and particularly the elders, is to oversee what's going on. Not necessarily to have authority over anybody, but to offer their wisdom, their observation, their opinion on what's going on. You see, that's what's been missing in the churches, particularly ours, the Church of God, in times past. I won't say this congregation, but those that are organized as our the typical among us, the split-off groups and so on, they all carry over a portion of this in their approach to how they govern. It creates a divide. It puts a block, it puts a damper on the expression of the older people, those that have wisdom in the church, against doing what they ought to do. God gave them oversight. It says we are to know them by their fruits. How would we do that if we're not evaluating what they're doing? In the second chapter of Revelation, the Ephesian congregation examined their leadership. And they discovered that many of their so-called apostles weren't apostles at all. and they blew their cover. How would that work out in the modern day? I mean, look at the problem that the Catholics are having right now with some of their high-ranking leaders. The membership a long time ago should have blown their cover, but it was covered up. Well, that happens in any organization of men, not excluding our own. How would the ministry act if they knew that they were being scrutinized by the people that they served? How would the ministry act if they knew that there wasn't a barrier between themselves and the people? That barrier being the overall organization that kind of protected them. If they did something wrong, it was presumed that the critic was wrong, whether they were or not. Now, I'm not saying there aren't cases where they weren't, but how would the ministry act? Let's broaden the question. Would things have been different among us had we had true elders in the church? Elders who could freely relate what they saw and understood. Would doctrines have been changed? Would people have been put out for speaking their minds? You see, that's the component that God wants in His church. For those who are of the faith, for those who have been there any length of time, He wants them to be able to have the stabilizing effect. But when we take that away, when we deny the elders their eldership, when we refuse to allow oversight from those, quote-unquote, below, we create a condition that leads to what we saw happen. Now, I suppose in the churches of this world, it doesn't matter all that much. But one thing I'll say for them is, they don't repudiate their own doctrines. But look what happened to us in a matter of 3 or 4 years. Those who were elders did the appropriate thing, the only thing they could do under the circumstance. They walked out, and they gathered together in different venues. Commendable in a way, but hopefully they wouldn't repeat the same pattern. The pattern is that there is a service-oriented or a servant class who basically rule and direct and guide the congregation, be it a church or be it a nation. And there are people within who offer their advice, who present their observations of what's going on. That's the important component. For any body to be healthy, its various functions need to be working properly. If your pancreas quits, problems. If your digestive system doesn't work properly, serious problems. If your liver quits, you're in trouble. A healthy body has all of its systems working properly. And it would be appropriate in any spiritual body that all of its systems be working properly. There needs to be elders in every congregation. Certainly, over time, as people grow, as people study and grow in grace and knowledge and gain a teaching ability, the Apostle Paul says in Hebrews 5, after so much time in the church, you ought to be teachers. And that certainly would include people who have been in the faith for any length of time, who have gained experience, who know the truth, and who aren't about to throw the truth in the trash can just because somebody gets into the chief seat. Have we learned anything? Now, I say most of these things not to suggest that this congregation isn't set up that way. I think we are. We have elders, whether we have recognized the fact or not. It's certainly part of how we operate. I would encourage every Church of God group to operate in the same manner, where the elders within have a say, who can stabilize the church, who can keep it from drifting off mark, who can address matters of impropriety or poor treatment, who can be the pillars and guide and stays of the truth that they ought to be. That's what God wants in His church, and that's why He hates Nicolaitanism, because that is the very opposite. It makes the clergy class conquerors of the people. They have all the say. A strong and stable church is those that has elders. Elders by means of, certainly, of age in the truth. And we ought to recognize who they are. Now, let's ask the question. I think I asked it earlier. Will there be elders in the millennial kingdom? They certainly will. Whether you like it or not, if you've been called of God and if you've been in the faith for any length of time, eldership is going to come your way. God is going to expect you to be the elder that you should be, appropriate to the length of time, appropriate to the studying that you've done, appropriate to the knowledge and wisdom that you've gained. We're being trained for God's kingdom. And even though you or I may never be made a minister of any degree, doesn't matter so much. In the kingdom, the talents, the experience that we've gained is going to be called upon. So let's not forget that. God's family, God's church, both in ancient times, on earth and in heaven, has elders. Elders of the people. Elders who intervene between the people and God. So let's recognize and let's all strive to be elders indeed.